If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It began with a dead-of-night break-in and ended with a White House resignation. On June 17, 1972, five men broke into the Democratic Party's National Committee offices in Washington's Watergate complex. The third-rate burglary triggered a first-rate national crisis. By the time President Nixon resigned in August 1974, more than 30 officials had been convicted, and America's trust in high public office was in ruins. 30 years later, the lessons of Watergate and their implications for the U.S. government and people today. We begin tonight at the beginning with the break-in at the Watergate. Gerald Alch is now a judge in Massachusetts, but 30 years ago he found himself at the epicenter of Watergate's opening crime when he defended convicted Watergate burglar James McCord. Good evening, Honorable Jerry Alch.
Good evening. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
You were in this from the beginning, I guess. You were representing McCord, one of the men convicted in the Watergate burglary and plot. How did that come about? How did you get the job?
At the time, I was a partner of F. Lee Bailey, and the day after the break-in, McCord called our office and wanted Bailey to represent him. At the time, Lee was involved in a very lengthy out-of-state murder trial. Spoke to McCord about me, put us together. He liked me, I liked him, and he retained me.
Back then, Jerry Alch, did you have any idea that this was more than a night's strange break-in at an apartment and office complex?
Not for a moment. I was very, very naive, especially as to the atmosphere in Washington. It was a city of paranoia at the time, and my job was to focus on just the charges against my client, which sounded in burglary.
Do you remember how you perceived what you were hearing, what you were being told? Did you believe that this guy was just going in to steal some copy paper or whatever he was after?
Well, I put it right on him. I said to him, well, why did you do this? And he explained to me that in his capacity as chief of security for the Committee to Reelect the President, known as CREEP, he had reason to believe that the Democratic National Party was funding the very, very violent anti-Vietnam War demonstrations that were taking place in Washington at that time. He also had reason to believe that these violent demonstrations constituted a threat of danger to the life of the president. And he also thought that if they could obtain documentary evidence linking the Democratic Party to these anti-war demonstrations, linking them financially and other ways, this could be very, very valuable to the Republicans. They believed that by breaking into Larry O'Brien's office, who was the head of the Democratic Committee, they might be able to find such information. That's what he told me.
So, but even at that, it was clear this was not an ordinary burglary. This was, you were right in the thick of things pretty quickly.
Absolutely. And my problem was to try to put together a legally recognized defense, because they were caught under a desk with their butts sticking out. You couldn't argue they weren't there. You couldn't argue the purpose for which they were there.
Pretty tough job for a young attorney. What was James McCord ultimately convicted of?
A burglary.
And the judge in that trial was John Sirica, another one of these great Watergate names. He became the, sort of the personification of justice in those trials. What were your impressions of Judge Sirica then? I know you sparred with him a bit, didn't you?
I thought he was a very, very tough judge. I thought he did things during the trial that were quite irregular. As an example, during the prosecution's case, as it was drawing to a close, he asked me and G. Gordon Liddy's attorney, who were the only two defendants on trial at that time, into his chambers and instructed us off the record to tell our clients, quote, tell your client it's still not too late to go before the grand jury. I did what I was told. My client, as did Liddy, vigorously turned that offer down. I slept on it overnight and thought it was highly improper for a judge to do that. I went into Judge Sirica's lobby the next day and on the record asked that he recuse himself and an alternative for a mistrial, both of which were denied.
And now, from a distance of almost 30 years, how do you see Judge Sirica?
Still tough. I still think that was improper. As a matter of fact, in my motion for stay of execution of sentence at the end of the trial, I referred to the incident that I've just described to you, and from the bench, he threatened to send a transcript of that my argument to the Massachusetts Board of Bar Overseers, saying that I had breached his confidence as far as what was supposed to have been private that went on in his lobby. So he tolerated nothing except what he saw as where he wanted to go.
Judge Alch, you like all of us saw this then mushroom into the enormous story that it became. Do you remember how you became aware that this was more, much more than just a burglary?
My client began to ask me questions about various White House officials about whom I had no knowledge whatsoever. After his conviction, but prior to his sentencing, the day of his sentencing, he delivered, without my knowledge, a letter to Judge Sirica, alleging that perjury had been committed by various witnesses during the trial. I had no knowledge of this. When it came time to sentence Liddy, Judge Sirica, from the bench, read that letter.
From your client?
From my client, and called a 20-minute recess. Every reporter in that courtroom turned and made a mad dash for the nearest payphone, a scene right out of a movie. The only two people remaining in the courtroom were McCord and me. I turned to him and said, "What the hell is going on here?" And he replied, "I'm doing this for your own good. I'm keeping you out of it for your own good." Mm-hmm. And he so reflected that in writing at the end of the letter, mm-hmm, that he was intentionally keeping that from me.
All these years later, when we learned the whole story, when the White House hand in this is long ago revealed and a president left office, everything that came after, given where you began at the heart of this whole scandal, what does the legacy of Watergate mean to you, Judge Alch, today?
I think that was the beginning of the legitimizing of the heavy, heavy press coverage of any politician, especially the President of the United States. I often wonder if the tapes had not been discovered or had they been destroyed by President Nixon, it would have been his word against his counsel's word, John Dean, and the outcome might have been entirely different. So the motto is you can't break the law without expecting to be nailed on it because of the ever tenacious, and I think justifiably so, role of the press in very closely watching elected public officials, especially with the president.
So that's the takeaway for politicians. What about for the country? What do you think is the most important thing for the United States, for the people of America, to remember of Watergate?
That the people and the press representing the people have a legitimate, strong role in how this country is run, because I believe it was the will of the people that brought Nixon down, the public clamor magnified by the press. Mm-hmm. Let me just say this at the risk of antagonizing some of your listeners. In retrospect, and I only speak for myself, President Nixon had some very positive factors going for him as far as his accomplishments as a president. He certainly ended on the wrong note, that's for sure. But as history progresses, he did a lot of things that, especially in foreign policy, that you could say was a good contribution to the country.
But Watergate was not survivable.
It brought him down.
Judge Alch, Gerald Alch, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
It's been a pleasure.
Gerald Alch was the lawyer for convicted Watergate burglar James McCord. He's now a judge in Massachusetts. If the Vietnam War and Watergate defined their era, the war on terrorism certainly defines this one. Both speak to American vulnerability and the power of the federal government and, in particular, the presidency. In the Nixon White House, power was criminally misused. Today, President Bush is using federal law to fight a new kind of war. Again, White House power and secrecy are in play. Does the national experience of Watergate make you more confident that the country and the president will get it right this time? And 30 years on, what did America learn from Watergate? What's been remembered? What's been forgotten? And where were you in 72? And how do you explain it all to your students, to your children? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're diving into the murky Watergate waters tonight with historian Stanley Cutler, who unmasked Richard Nixon in his groundbreaking books, The Wars of Watergate, The Last Crisis of Richard Nixon, and The New Nixon Tapes, Abuse of Power. Good evening and welcome, Stanley Cutler.
Hello.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
With us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Cutler.
Stanley Cutler, you're like us, hearing all the coverage that's going on this 30th anniversary of Watergate. There's been a lot of attention paid on this particular anniversary to the identity of Deep Throat and where word came from for Woodward and Bernstein. As you look back on Watergate, with all of its implications, ramifications, and all of your study of Richard Nixon's role in that time, what do you see as the most important legacy of that scandal?
Certainly not Deep Throat. if I could just, you know, comment on what's going on in the last couple of days. It said there was a poll that came out today. It said 2/3 of Americans don't know enough about Watergate to discuss it. But I'll bet you they're familiar with the term Deep Throat. Because what this has been, it's been a typical manifestation of media self-glorification, that we did Watergate. We were at the heart of the story. This is sheer nonsense.
You mean the anniversary observance turns into a self-congratulatory thing?
Well, self-congratulatory thing in this, with this endless query about Deep Throat. I'll bet you that more people could tell you about Deep Throat as a Watergate figure that could tell you that could than can tell you about Deep Throat as a pornographic movie figure today.
We take your point that the kind of Professor Plum in the library with a candlestick aspect of Deep Throat is mesmerizing, and maybe there's some media self-congratulation. But if you were master of media, what's the message, what's the legacy of Watergate that you would point at and say, here's where significance lies?
Well, I would say that this is the occasion to remind people of who and what Richard Nixon was, what he did. Your previous guest said that he did some things that are notable in foreign policy. I don't know what he said, China, I suppose. The Nixon people would like to say peace with honor in Vietnam, which, as we have found out through the unfolding of scholarship, that Admiral Zumwalt had it right 25 years ago, that there were two words that did not characterize the Paris Peace Accords. One was peace, the other was honor. It's Watergate that is at the heart of Richard Nixon's administration. Whatever any textbook says about Richard Nixon 50, 100 years from now, it will begin by saying Richard Nixon, the first president of the United States to ever resign because of scandal, then may go on to say he did this or he did that, But it's going to say that he resigned because of scandal. So what is the scandal? Well, it's his abuse of power, his obstruction of justice, the alleged the proven criminality of obstructing the Watergate investigation. But the interesting thing is that for the media, the story hasn't changed in 30 years. And the fact is that the story has changed.
How's that exactly?
Well, it's changed because of the unfolding of the documentary record that has come out steadily through the years. Let me give you just one example to illustrate my point. We all know about John Dean's famous cancer on the presidency talk with the president on March 21st, 1973. John Dean goes to see the president. He has been the ringmaster of the cover-up. Nixon knows everything that Dean has been doing because they've met before. Dean reviews it all for him and says to the president, you know, that you've got to get out ahead of this story. Heads have to roll to save yourself. It was really what Dean was doing was coming forth and saying, you know, you have to save yourself and your administration. Now, this is an incredibly crucial moment for Nixon. We now know, as a result of the new tapes that have come out, that as soon as John Dean walked out of that office, In walked Rosemary Woods, his longtime secretary, and Nixon says to her, "You know that money that you got in that file cabinet? I need it. I need it for a political purpose." He needed it to continue paying the hush money to the burglars is what he needed it for.
The cancer on the pregnancy would not be cut out on that day, and maybe never. Stanley Cutler,
he wasn't going to cut off the cover-up.
He wasn't. Stand by. We're going to take a short break here. We're talking about Watergate, 30 years on, with Stanley Cutler, author of The Wars of Watergate. You can join the conversation tonight. Where were you in 72, and what are your Watergate memories? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Get everything straight. Who's told a hen? I want the hen to all go lay. Say so much of water getting my home, I just probably got my first taste.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Watergate on the 30th anniversary of the break-in at the Washington complex that set off a national scandal that brought down a president and, for many people, brought down American trust in government. What's your sense of the lasting legacy of Watergate? Could Watergate happen again? And are we going back to the unchecked presidential power and secrecy that laid the groundwork for Watergate in 1972? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Stanley Cutler. For 25 years, he's fought for the release. He fought for the release of the Nixon tapes. He's author of The Wars of Watergate and Abuse of Power, The New Nixon Tapes. Stanley Cutler, listeners who were not 30, obviously were not even born in 1972 at the time of Watergate, and many, you know, who are under 25 probably have little memory of it. Take us through, in just the most simple terms, the key elements that turned this into a national scandal.
Well, the burglary occurs 30 years ago tonight. But, you know, it really wasn't much of a national story. The country was preoccupied with the election. It was really, in classic terms, a local Washington story. It's interesting. Walter Cronkite tried to make a national story of it on CBS. Mm-hmm. He scheduled two long programs. The second was cut short. We do know that great paragon of virtue, Charles Colson, had a little telephone conversation with the powers that be at CBS, and they backed off. But the fact is, the story wasn't resonating. In fact, on September 5th, 1972, Dean comes in and meets the president and gives him a long report. He says, "I assure you, you have 54 days in which you don't have anything to worry about, namely his reelection." And Nixon wins overwhelming reelection, but then after the election, the cover-up begins to unravel. There are various things. Your previous guest talked about McCord, McCord's letter, and so forth. I think the crucial event is the holding of the hearings by the Senate Select Committee, Sam Mervin and six other senators. It was an incredible investigation. I always thought that the first 37 days of those hearings are really a model of congressional fairness and investigation, dealing with witnesses and so forth. And all the president's men came to testify. The former attorney general, the president's former law partner, John Mitchell, referred to the White House horrors of the previous 4 years. And we began to hear things, and more stories unfolded. And, of course, then there was Dean's testimony. There was Howard Baker's famous question, which has been quoted ad nauseum: what did the president know and when did he know it? That was really designed to embarrass Dean. That was really to put Dean's word against the president, and who are you going to believe? And on July 23rd, a man named Alexander Butterfield admitted to the committee that the president had taped conversations in the Oval Office and other parts of the White House. On that date, the Watergate story changes. Then we can know what the president knew and when he knew it. And the rest of the Watergate story is really a search for the truth via the tapes. In other words, via the words of Richard Nixon.
And the great crime that makes this has often been described as an assault like no other on the U.S. Constitution?
Well, what we begin to find out along the way is some further evidence of these White House horrors, most notably the Plumbers, the group that was you know, the president
the break-in
authorized
gang.
To break into the private offices of private citizens of the United States. John Ehrlichman, the president's aide, told the Senate committee that, when he said, he was asked about that, he said, don't you believe that a man's house is his castle? He says, well, some of us don't believe that very much anymore, Senator. And Senator Herman Talmadge, a man with a nice, deep Georgia drawl, said to him, well, Mr. Ehrlichman, people in my part of the country do. And the look on Ehrlichman's face, he knew he was dead in the water then.
Jack Beatty, join us here. We've heard of, in the years since, Iran Gate and Travel Gate and even Monica Gate, but this is the great granddaddy.
Yes, it is. And I want to hear Professor Cutler on this, and especially on the character of Richard Nixon. You know, what I can't understand, Professor, is how did Richard Nixon get to be president? His character was known. I was brought up on stories about his campaigns in California after he lost to Pat Brown in 1962, running for governor of California.
I lived out there then.
He made a statement on television that was just so palpably full of self-pity, you thought, well, I actually felt sorry for him. Uriah Heep. And yet, this man who didn't seem to represent anything decent in his life of politics rose to the top. How? What did that say about us?
Well, you're right on the money. You know, the thing in really many in the ways, in the final analysis, it all boils down to the question of this character, of who he was and what he was. And you asked, how did he become president? Well, the fact is that the election of 1960 was a very narrow, close contest, and there was a lot of confusion. The country was at sea. In many ways, one has to understand that Watergate is a product, ultimately, of Vietnam. And the conflict in this country over Vietnam. And Nixon made some vague allusions to the fact that he was going to bring peace in Vietnam and so forth. So did Humphrey. But I think people, out of frustration, out of dissatisfaction with what had been going on for the previous 4 years, turned to Nixon, albeit reluctantly, no question about it, reluctantly. So we get Nixon as president, but the truth is, for the next 3 years, Richard Nixon expended enormous energy and effort to try to win the Vietnam War. He believed it was winnable. It isn't until the spring of 1971 as the new tapes show us again of what he really thought, of what he was really trying to do. But, you know, during 72, the discrediting of George McGovern, whatever one may think of McGovern's capabilities is one thing. But, I mean, this man was made out to be some sort of moral monster, an utter incompetent, and so on. And Nixon wins in a breeze. The fact is he once again becomes a controversial figure. But, you know,
to say the least.
Yeah. But, you know, when we talk about the character of Richard Nixon, there's something else again. I'm sorry to keep referring to the new tapes, but again, you know, it shows how the story has had an added richness through the years. You know, the question that haunted us back in, I love when the media comes on now and say, well, there are unanswered questions about Watergate. One of them is deep throat. One of them is, why did they break it? Well, we know we don't know why they broke it, and we probably will never find out the specific reason. But, for example, a question that we used to ask ourselves, why didn't Nixon come forth and tell the truth? The evidence was overwhelming. The polls were overwhelming. If Nixon had come forth and said, I did it, and even if he did it in typical Nixonian fashion by saying, I did it for you, I did it to save you from the rapists, from the abortionists, from the commies, what have you, I did it for you. The country didn't want to destroy a president. But he didn't do it. And new tapes have a couple of statements where he says, for example, he's talking about the plumbers. Now, this is a man who had spent 30 years in American public life as Mr. Goody Two-Shoes, as, you know, I'm Mr. Law and Order and all that sort of stuff. He says, to admit that I, as president, allowed a break-in of someone's office, I can't say that. It was the truth was excruciatingly painful for him.
Stanley Cutler, Jack Beatty, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome in to join us Anthony Lewis, longtime columnist for the New York Times who covered the Watergate, among many other eras and issues of constitutional law in American history. Good evening and welcome, Anthony Lewis.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. Tony Lewis, we're looking back from 30 years now. The anniversaries just go by 20, 25, 30. Now it's 30 years. We're in the middle of a new war, a different kind of war. What legacy do you see emerging over time as the most important lesson of Watergate? And I guess take us, if you will, also to where we are now with the Bush White House, the new war. Should we have active concerns about what we've learned about presidential power, its limits, its potential abuses?
Well, I agree with Professor Cutler. The real legacy is the fear of concentrated power exercised in secret. It should be. But, you know, Americans have very short attention spans and very little knowledge of history. We're just not a historical-minded people. And we forget. So we had Watergate, and all of us thought we'd learned our lesson. It was pretty well driven home to us that he was a man who cheated on his income taxes and did terrible things to people on his enemies list and used presidential power about as profligately as you can imagine. And, you know, nobody knows that anymore. I agree with Professor Cutler. We have to learn it again.
Well, do you see the makings of acute concern in the new concentration of power and new reputation for secrecy that we see in the White House in the time of a new war?
I think it's an excellent reason, and I think you were quite right to pose it, Tom, as the basic underlying thrust of this subject. I think it's there's every reason for concern that once again we have power exercised in secret, and now any challenge to that secrecy or that exercise of power is met with a claim that whoever is challenging it is against America, is weakening the war on terrorism. You know, Nixon tried also to make patriotism his defense when he fired Archie Cox in the Saturday Night Massacre, the Watergate special prosecutor, mm-hmm. I should say, for the 90% of Americans who don't remember who Archibald Cox was, fired him and tried to enlist the help of his attorney general, Elliot Richardson, on the ground that it was the patriotic duty to help the president fire Archibald Cox. Patriotism is certainly, in that instance, and I think threateningly again now, the last refuge of a scoundrel.
Jack Beatty, are you as unimpressed as Anthony Lewis with American memory and American sense of history? Do you feel this kind of concern that we're at risk in a new war of perhaps not a Watergate, but some other abuse of presidential power and secrecy?
Well, we have the same claim that the president made, President Nixon made, when he would not release the tapes of his conversations. We had that same claim being made repeatedly by the White House, executive privilege. The vice president has made it about what seemed to be properly transparent meetings that he had with people that should be the business of that. In other words, the government should report. The president, you know, we've heard this again and again. So just in that invocation, you see that. And I do think something else happens to these presidents. They identify themselves with the country. Mm-hmm. And they sort of see the country as themselves.
I'm America, and America is me.
Yeah, and there's this kind of unaccountable power. And you know, President Bush talks often as if he sort of can't. Who would ever dream of challenging him about anything? I mean, his motives are perfectly good. They don't seem to have understood the founding fathers and their vision of power, which is that it's an inherent evil, and the only thing that can keep it straight is countervailing power.
But 30 years after Watergate, President Bush has struck a pose that is gaining him an awful lot of support. Greg's on the line. Welcome, Greg. You're on the air.
I just wanted to bring up the topic. I mean, as you mentioned yourself, I mean, the Iran-Contra. I mean, I see that as a period where the White House is vagrantly breaking the law, but yet, as you said, you know, cloaked in patriotism, the public and the media kind of turned an eye to it.
Mm-hmm. So
I think, if I may, it's Tony Lewis here.
Yes.
Now, that was the fact that the public and the media turned away from it. Had to do with the fact that the president was a chap called Ronald Reagan, and people loved him and were afraid to challenge him He was sort of above reproach, although, you know, he didn't really know much of what was going on in that or other matters by that point. But I assure you that if Richard Nixon had been president, there would have been a much tougher response to Iran-Contra.
And who should be the sentry here, Stanley Cutler? Should the press be the one keeping everybody up on their toes? Is Congress letting us down? Or is there just something inherent in our system that allows for cyclical emergence of the, as we said in Nixon's era, the imperial presidency?
Well, the fact is that the imperial presidency is by and large welcomed. For however much we say we abhor power, we're skeptical toward power and so forth, the fact is that power more often than not will go unchecked. Now, we do have the task of a vigilant press. The question is how well they're fulfilling it. The same, too, of Congress. Now, there was some mention made here before of Attorney General Ashcroft. You remember his appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee mm-hmm. some months ago, and, you know, where they're getting ready, loaded for bear for him and so forth. And he just faced them down. He said the fact that any criticism of us is unpatriotic. And like wimps, they just rolled over on that one.
Mm. Oh, he almost equated it with treason.
Well, I don't remember that exactly. But the fact is that they did roll over. And Senator Leahy, my own Senator Feingold, had been severe critics of this process and said nothing in response to this.
Tony Lewis, what's your sense of the constitutional structure of American government and the dynamic roles that the different elements play? Have we learned from Watergate how to stay adequately aware of potential abuse? Use of executive authority.
Well, I agreed earlier with what Professor Cutler said about the press in Watergate. It did a valuable job, the Washington Post especially, but it wasn't really the final engine that drove Nixon from office. It was the formal institutions of government, the Congress, the Senate Committee Investigation, the Special Prosecutor, the Supreme Court played a very important role. Those institutions are there still, if they are prepared to intervene. What has to be some issue that focuses the minds of those institutions. For example, it could be the attempt of the Bush administration to put people away without a trial, without access to a lawyer. Mm. It's happening, and I think it's one of the most dangerous things that's ever happened in this country. There isn't much row about it, but there are hundreds of people, immigrants, who have been held for months, many, many months, without any charge being made against them, without any trial. And now there are people charged with criminal offenses, as you know, alleged people trying to set off dirty bombs and all that, without a trial. They're just sort of put away in a brig somewhere with no chance and no indictment, no chance to challenge it, and no access to a lawyer. To me, it's fundamentally un-American, and I'm waiting to see whether a court or someone will challenge this outrage.
Jack Beatty, maybe this is simply a perpetual area of risk for the American democracy, and we have to organically deal with it and maybe learn it again every time.
Well, especially in the context of war, which seems to, you know, I think the people give a grant of authority to the president. He has more liberty, and at the same time, it brings out the paranoia in presidents, and it certainly did in Richard Nixon. You know, the strange thing about Nixon, I remember someone remarking, it may have been Noam Chomsky, that getting him out of office for Watergate was a little like convicting Al Cohn for tax evasion, next to what he did in Vietnam.
It wasn't going to happen. We're talking about Watergate 30 years on, its legacy, what's been learned and what has not. What do you think is the lasting legacy of Watergate? Could it happen again? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Become yourself. Because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Watergate 30 years on. Our guests tonight are Stanley Cutler. He's author of The Wars of Watergate and Abuse of Power, The New Nixon Tapes, and Anthony Lewis, longtime columnist for The New York Times. What is the lasting legacy of Watergate to you? Could it happen again? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Jody's on the line. Welcome, Jody. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a young girl in Canada when Watergate, I guess, was committed, and I was an adolescent when the news was breaking.
Mm.
One of the first things I wanted to say was nobody was surprised in Canada. Nobody trusted Nixon. Nobody liked Nixon. We were surprised at how shocked Americans were about this.
You're an insightful bunch, you Canadians.
Well, but we also had a joke that we began to tell on ourselves a few years later, which is we would say when Americans discovered that their president had lied to them, had obstructed justice, had committed a crime, it precipitated a huge, you know, national crisis of conscience. The president had to resign.
Mm.
In Canada, when we discovered that the RCMP had been reading our mail for years illegally.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Yes, which is sort of our only national policing body. We passed a law so that they could do it legally.
Jody, what's your observation on the American front on Watergate today?
Well, my observation is it seems to me Americans are moving in that direction now, which is to say I think the lasting legacy of Watergate was Americans cannot go through that again. That was so devastating to the national psyche that there's been a tremendous amount of largely unconscious effort to make sure that nobody ever has to find out anything that terrible again.
You mean not to guard against it happening, but to guard against finding out?
To guard against finding out.
You're saying American journalists have been anesthetized to the next Watergate?
People don't want to know. I don't think people really want to know. They do not want to have their face shaken in that same way. And on the one side, they're a little more cynical. But on the other side, I think they really just want to push that kind of knowledge away. It's one thing to persecute Bill Clinton over largely personal matters of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite another thing to have to find out that the whole machinery of government is behind criminal actions and obstruction of justice.
That's an interesting observation, Jody. Thanks for sharing it. Anthony Lewis, what about it? An American aversion to trauma today that would not support sort of culturally a new Watergate investigation?
Well, let me speak as a member of the press. I mean, most reporters are so gung-ho by nature that if they saw a chance to undo a president, a la Woodward and Bernstein, or whatever you might want to call it, they would do it. I mean, I don't think the reporters I know would say, gee, we don't want to put the country through this again, so we won't write that story. That's not the way the press operates. But I think overall, there is, for both the press and for Congress, as Professor Cutler mentioned at the time that Attorney General Ashcroft appeared, there's a reluctance to seem to be carping at the war effort. It's called a war. It's a very peculiar kind of war.
Mm-hmm.
And under the guise of war, everybody is invited to rally behind the administration. And I think it's hard for reporters and for members of Congress to get away from that subtext, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they don't want to do their job. They do, but it's not so easy.
The invitation is a pretty firm one. Gene is on the line. Welcome, Gene. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Former hippie anti-war activist,
okay.
Turned lawyer in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and Nixon legacy thought police. We found out in our community of anti-war activists that within a year of him being elected the first time, we'd been publishing underground newspapers. One weekend, the entire press was dismantled and removed.
What's the lesson you carry forward today, Gene?
Well, what I see today is this, that Watergate was a natural extension of his animus against anybody that was against him, especially the anti-war activists. And, you know, it was no surprise to anybody that he did this. It was just a complete surprise that he got discovered.
And that he took it so far. Gene, thanks for your call. Stanley Cutler, what about it? The implication, again and again this hour, is that it was something perhaps unique to the character of Richard Nixon and his willingness to see enemies everywhere and step over boundaries that made Watergate happen. Does it take a character that that dark and paranoid, if you will, to produce this kind of scandal?
Well, like I said, a lot of it lies within the personality of Richard Nixon. Not sure many of these guys are very likable guys. Walter Lippmann said when somebody asked him when Nixon resigned, is he our worst president? He said, no, not our worst, our most embarrassing. He said, but you have to remember, presidents are not necessarily nice people. They have to do too much to get to where they're at.
But Ronald Reagan was famously likable. George Bush, you know, when you're on the bus, is said to be funny in a frat boy kind of way.
Yeah, but, you know, what they are on a kind of surface level and what they are underneath is something else. But look, yes, Nixon himself certainly accentuated the difficulties. But he did, you know, in his own special way. One lie led to another. One cover-up led to another kind of cover-up. And as things unraveled, he did himself in. And you know, other presidents have been their own worst enemies. One could make some of that argument for Clinton, although, you know, one of the things that's been going on the last few days that's kind of annoying is this this feeble nonsense that Watergate and Monica, whatever you want to call it, have some sort of moral and ethical parity, when, of course, there are two wholly different stories. We're dealing one with what a president was doing in his spare time with his spare life, and we're talking about what a president was doing while he was president and as president.
Anthony Lewis, when you look at the Bush-Cheney team, is there something in the character of these men that gives you confidence that we are less likely to go down an abusive power path?
No, because it's a different thing. There isn't that morbid paranoia of Nixon that everybody, the callers in and others have referred to on this program. Now, that was unique, and you asked, was it something unique to the character? Mm-hmm. Yes, that was. But there's just as much danger from unwitting abuse of power. I'm sure that George W. Bush thinks it's absolutely fair, honest, and in the interest of the country to deny people the right to a lawyer and a trial because we have to win this war. I think it's a constitutional outrage and more dangerous because it's done with goodwill than with the dark malevolence of Richard Nixon.
Anthony Lewis, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Anthony Lewis was a longtime columnist for the New York Times. And Stanley Cutler, thank you for being with
us
tonight. Stanley Cutler is author of Abuse of Power, The New Nixon Tapes. Jack Beatty, last word about the reverberations of Watergate. Are they diminishing?
No, I don't think they are. I mean, I think it's out there as a kind of legacy. The impeachment of Bill Clinton, I think, was one of its legacies. The Republicans were just, at the time, they were saying, we're going to get their president. They got ours. You might say it was their tat for his tit. And Trent Lott was, of course, one of the active men in both episodes. And it lives on in the changed character of the Democratic Party, which after Watergate really ran on reform issues and rules issues and got away from the bread and butter issues that had made it the party of the working people, such that it carries Marin County by 36 points but loses Kentucky counties that George McGovern carried by 51 points. So a lot of repercussions, I think, from Watergate.
And the Watergate word itself lives on. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on forums. In a moment, sympathy for the woman charged with starting the huge Colorado wildfire. This is On Point. Apparently, the vast forest fire burning through Colorado was accidentally started by an unlikely source, a veteran U.S. Forest Service employee, Terry Barton. She allegedly went into the woods and burned a letter from her estranged husband while on patrol about a week ago. She then extinguished her small fire, or so she thought. When she returned to the spot, the huge wildfire was already on its way toward catastrophe. Boston University journalism professor Carol Rivers says she understands the anger that those who have lost property in the fire feel toward Terry Barton. But she asks, haven't we all done stupid things in our lives?
Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Recently, a forest ranger fumed and set half of Colorado on fire. Nero was a nasty guy who deliberately set the Eternal City ablaze. By all accounts, the forest ranger was a devoted worker and a mother of two who just had the bad luck most of us can only shudder about. She burned a letter from her estranged husband in a spot that was supposedly safe for small fires. But a gust of wind kicked up the flames. She desperately tried to stamp them out, but they got away, and the rest, as they say, is history. My heart goes out to this woman because I myself was once a near arsonist in quite a different set of circumstances. My pyromania involved something rather more ethereal and less passionate than an ex-lover. I tried to burn a saint. There's a rather famous literary allusion to this subject. One of the men who lit the kindling as Joan of Arc was sentenced to death by the British cried aloud, "God forgive me, for I have burned a saint." I, however, did not implore the Almighty because I was only a sophomore in high school and did not really set a saint afire, just the image of one. The order of nuns who ran my high school had been founded by a very saintly woman, Mother Marie. We had to reenact her life every year in pageants staged in the gymnasium, and her life was not chock full of drama. One scene, for example, had a kid dressed up in the clothing of the late 1800s. She'd clasp her hands to her heart, look heavenward, and exclaim, "I will found an order of nuns." Ben-Hur, it wasn't. It was only after her death that Mother Marie really cranked up the drama quotient. To qualify for sainthood, candidates have to have at least one miracle to their credit. Mother Marie, it seems, was rather good at stopping fires, at least. That was what the nuns told us. At the time, I was on the staff of the student newspaper, and as journalists of all ages are wont to do, we tried hard to cultivate an attitude of worldly skepticism. This was somewhat hard in the innocent days when good Catholic children were supposed to be seen and not heard, and the words scandal and church were never uttered in tandem. But we decided that while the stories of Mother Marie's talents were quite interesting, definitive proof was needed if she was really going to get to be a saint. So a small group of us, brownie camera in hand, troop off to the athletic field with a stack of Mother Marie holy cards. She appeared to be a rather stern-looking woman, but after all, Vogue photographers probably did not snap the official portraits of potential saints. She looked a lot like the nun who taught us algebra. This particular nun had a collection of African violets in her classrooms, which students were supposed to water. I once watered them from the top instead of the bottom, and she flew into a rage, accusing me of violeticide. She threatened to blackball me from the National Honor Society because of half-drowning the violets, until my mother came in for a very firm talk and saved my bacon. So maybe, deep in my heart, I really wanted Mother Marie to fail. Dutifully, we set one Mother Marie card aflame. It burned to a crisp. We tried another. Same result. "Mother Marie isn't doing so hot," said an associate editor. "Let's try more," I said. We set a whole batch of Mother Marie's on fire, and the same fate befell us that befell the forest ranger. A gust of wind came along. Mother Marie's, flaming on the edges, started wafting across the athletic field. When they landed near dried blades of grass, the rain-starved grass began to burn. I ran hither and yon, stomping on burning Mother Marie's. I figured I'd really blown the National Honor Society now. Croaking a few violets was a minor offense, but burning down the school was quite another matter. And how could I explain to the Pope that I had torpedoed one of his saints? Sorry, Holy Father, but maybe Mother Marie really isn't in the same league as Peter and Paul. A fire sensor somewhere in the school picked up the scent of smoke, and in a few minutes we heard the wail of sirens. We hightailed it out of there, clutching the unburnt Mother Marie's in our sweaty palms. Fortunately, the wind died down, and instead of a great conflagration, there were just a few charred patches somewhere near second base. So I have real empathy for the forest ranger who just wanted to burn a letter from a guy who really got her steamed and ending up burning down half her state. She could be sentenced to 10 years in prison and to a fine of $250,000. She didn't mean it. Give her a break. Blackball her from the Firefighters Hall of Fame, of course, but don't throw her in the slammer. We've all done really dumb things in our lives. Luckily, a lot of us just didn't get caught. There, but for the grace of God, go all of us.
Carol Rivers is a professor of journalism at Boston University. Terry Barton, accused of starting the Colorado forest fire, is being held in Colorado Springs. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.